Yankees Files Podcast. We are back. I'm Will Harris. You're Alec Whipple. And while the rest of you may not be pleased with the way that the Yankees played this week, I do have some phenomenal news. Folks, it hasn't been a good year for the Yankees, but it is August 27th, and the Irish are undefeated. Had to get that one in there, Whipple. I loved the 42-3 performance that the Irish put on in Dublin against the Navy midshipmen yesterday, Saturday. And I'm going to be insufferable about Notre Dame this year is if they are as good as they appear they may be. And I think that's my right. You know, I am a co-host and co-proprietor of this blog and podcast and everything. And if I want to use it to just be obnoxious about college football, I'm more than willing to do that. So that's what's getting me through this rough week. How are you feeling?
Well, it is kind of sad that it's August 27th and this time last year, we had about 2 months left of baseball to look forward to. And now we are kind of in football season. I mean,
It's not sad that it's August 27th and the Irish are undefeated.
It's not sad. I as the podcast co-host, who's probably less of a football fan, I'm kind of also looking forward to just something else. But
sure,
state of the Yankees is, I think that kind of says it all. It was a week. It definitely feels weird. I think this is the first time we've done an episode, and I'm just like kind of. For context, we're going to be talking about a lot of fun things we can be looking at for the rest of the year. But in terms of wins and losses, I don't know. I mean, this might be the first Yankees Falls episode that maybe you feel differently, but I feel like we've kind of made our peace that this just isn't going to happen. I mean, I think the 0-6 week really did that, but at the end of that week, at least the prospects were called up and we were looking forward. And now it's just kind of here with this team for a month, and it doesn't feel great, but at the same time, I think we're past the point of being surprised. And there's certainly a lot that happened, both good and bad, but it seems like the story of the 2023 Yankees is almost written, and that is largely going to be a story of failure. And that's, I don't know. I don't know how to feel. I think this is the earliest in the season that I felt like this. And in the other Yankees non-playoff years that we can remember, there was always something else to focus on. And this, you know, there always are things, but it's different. And I think we're going to be sitting with this one for a little while. Not to do an obituary now, but that's, I think, this finally set in for all of us.
I think you're right with respect to at least how I am feeling about living and dying with individual wins and losses and where this team is. I would like to talk to you about something my dad texted me about this morning, because I think he's missing what we're saying, failing to pick up what we're putting down. And I think that's relatively common on Twitter as well, as far as people misinterpreting certain things that we are talking about and the way we're talking about why the Yankees have ended up where they have. So my dad texted me this morning and said, I would love to hear you and Whipple talk about the Yankees 4 or 5 player lineup and how that has exacerbated the team's bad luck. And I said, those ideas aren't related. If they had a 9-man lineup and still had batted ball luck this bad, I didn't even mention the injuries, but those would obviously play into it as well, they'd still be massively underachieving. You might say having this lineup lowers the floor, but it's not related to the luck discussion. He said they're 1,000% related. When some guys are down, others should pick them up, but that doesn't happen when you field guys who can't contribute. I said, I also don't think there's much more to say. They came into the season with a team that was expected to be very good. We've said they could have and should have hedged more, or could have responded differently to the things that have happened. Not sure what else there is to say. He then made his same appeal about the Dodgers, and then he said, unless you're saying if some players have bad luck, everyone has bad luck. I said, I'm saying having a better option at third base doesn't influence how often Gleyber Torres gets hits on opposite field line drives. And then I looked into the Dodgers thing. The Dodgers came into the season ready and willing to depend on Miguel Rojas, Miguel Vargas, Chris Taylor, Jason Hayward, Austin Barnes, James Outman, who was a 26-year-old who was never even a prospect, who's been ridiculous. And then between MVP-level seasons from Mookie Betts and Freddie Freeman, ridiculous batted ball luck for Outman and Hayward, and just strong seasons from the pitching staff, they've covered up for all of it. But really, it's that their two best players are having transcendent seasons. What I said at the end was, if, you know, Mookie Betts and Freddie Freeman, or if Mookie Betts had run into a wall and his foot had exploded, and Freddie Freeman had a concussion that led to him having the two worst months of his career and then an IL stint, the Dodgers would suck. Like, I get that we all want the Yankees to have the best player at every position for the entire year, every year, but where do you stand on the argument he's making that the Yankees having the roster they have has made their bad luck more relevant to their results? Because I'm really not super sold on it.
Well, I think for the Dodgers thing, the Dodgers to me kind of seem like a heightened version of the 2022 Yankees. Like, if you had two Aaron Judges, you look at that team by their production, essentially the Anthony Rizzo through DJ LeMahieu replicates pretty well, if not better in some places, the JD Martinez through James Outman. So what, you add on another guy or two in the Dodgers, slightly deeper. Obviously, if you had two guys who were hitting, you know, as well as Mookie Betts and Freddie Freeman last year, it's great. But Aaron Judge was clearly better than both of them. So, like, what I'm saying is, like, it all kind of evens out. And I think, and we go back to that team being labeled as a team that was a failure, did not play well, something that should have been, you know, the warning light should have been on. And I think that's what your dad is saying, where they should have hedged and brought in multiple top flight options to get to the point where the Dodgers are. But I think what we see with the Yankees is that if everyone was hitting like 2022 and Aaron Judge was slightly worse, this team would still be a good team. Like, the fact of the matter is that the Yankees had the guys, and I completely agree. I don't think the Yankees hitters have not performed well this year. There has been luck. There's been poor performance. That's all true. This is not removing blame, but the Yankees had the guys, and they could have brought in more, but they certainly had the guys who could do it and did it last year. And it, I think, really, again, this overarching question that influences how someone like your dad thinks of, are the 2022 and 2023 Yankees a failure combined? Because to me, it's that the 2022 Yankees were a success, and that version of the team hit on a lot of positive outcomes that this year's version of the team didn't hit on, both in luck and skill. And so that's, again, that could have been maybe handled differently, but I don't think looking at the Dodgers and saying, oh yeah, the Yankees, it was within their capabilities to do that, and they should have done it because it was clear that you were never going to be able to approach that level, and you're running out, you know, a lineup that's half full of guys who are going to, you know, strike out, or, you know, the reasoning is just not there. And I think this team certainly has been getting away with running out some guys who have been offensive black holes, like at the catcher position. But I don't think that influences anything else. Like, at the end of the day, it goes back to what we were saying of the core group, the non-Aaron Judge players, the Rizzo through DJ LeMahieu, all hitting collectively worse, and nobody else rising up as depth besides a better shortstop. So it's, I think it's like a way to take a lot of unconnected things and connect them together. And like, I don't know, if you ran the 2023 Yankees back exactly as they were, like, in some alternate reality, I kind of want to see that just to prove people wrong, because I think the team would do a lot better. I don't think that's crazy, right?
No, I think you're exactly correct. And one thing I want to point out. So Josh Donaldson, in the four seasons leading up to his age 36 season with the Yankees, which was last year, had a 127 WRC plus and 10.1 Fangraphs WAR. JD Martinez, in the four seasons leading up to his age 35 season with the Los Angeles Dodgers, had a 122 WRC plus and 6.2 Fangraphs WAR. So, like, my dad, a guy like my dad, would say, oh, well, look at the depth the Dodgers brought in by getting a guy like JD Martinez. Well, that's what the Yankees did last year with Josh Donaldson.
Yeah.
My dad has never hated a baseball player other than maybe Cody Epley more than he hates Josh Donaldson. So, like, it, I mean, his argument this whole time has been flawed from giving Melky Cabrera and Robinson Cano credit for production they had after 2009 as a reason to have believed in them in 2009, to the fact that the Dodgers are going to give 200 plate appearances to Austin Barnes and 400 to below average Chris Taylor, and the fact that they are okay with just a complete dumpster fire at the shortstop position, the fact that Max Muncy is having a good year, but wasn't he bad last year? Like, yeah, he was basically a league average hitter last year. It was his worst non-COVID season as a Dodger. Like, I understand where he's coming from, but it doesn't feel to me like the facts are on his side.
Yeah, I think the Dodgers are just not the example, because that's the team. Like, there are examples. I mean, if you want to compare the Yankees to the Braves, like, you're never, I don't think us reasonably could sit on here and say that we're going to be able to win that argument and say the Yankees are better constructed than the Braves. But
they're not.
The Dodgers came in with a lot of holes this year and started off down and have really rebounded because of the transcendent play of Mookie Betts and Freddie Freeman that have still covered up a lot of holes from, you know, the guys who are not part of the 4-7 hitters. I mean, all that's to say, again, this is kind of similar to the 2022 Yankees. They're not a perfect team as built this year, but if you have really good guys, it lets you get away with a lot of things, similar to last year. I mean, I don't have to keep saying it. It's just, it's very stark in my mind, because that last year's team, I think, was a team that had a lot of success. This year's team obviously is different, but the difference comes not from the depth options, but from the top level guys.
Totally. 100%. And maybe more people will understand that now that they're not just hearing it coming from their idiot son, and they're hearing it coming from their idiot son's lawyer friend.
I will support Mitch Harris because he did follow me on LinkedIn, and I do appreciate that. So
you're all about the professional network. You've always said that.
I love a good LinkedIn connection.
I've always said you can judge a man by the quality of his professional network.
Exactly. I'm just resume ready for transferring podcasts, the free agency period.
This is like your mom always says her favorite part of the podcast is the banter. This is going to be like her favorite episode. It's nothing but banter. We refuse to talk about the games. We just have a chat.
Crazy. The quality of the podcast goes up when the team quality goes down.
Yeah, it's funny. My girlfriend was saying the other day, she was saying, do your tweets do better when the Yankees are bad? And I said, you know, they kind of do. Like, our follower count, and thank you to everyone who's following us on Twitter, has kind of exploded since really the All-Star break. And just as far as you think about, like, you know, followers per week or followers per month that we're adding. So thank you to everyone who's done that. But it's interesting, because what that says to me is, for as much crap as we take online for being, whatever people say, shills, delusional, apologists, you know, people not liking our explanations of why the team has ended up where they are. Clearly, is this like the silent majority that we're seeing or something? Because we've attracted, and I've said it on multiple podcasts, we've attracted, I think, like the thoughtful, analytical, smart, measured Yankee fan. And that person isn't super loud or obnoxious, but I do think, and to be clear, I am loud and obnoxious. So I am unlike a lot of these people.
I'm not loud and obnoxious. That's why I got dragged into this.
But I think it's interesting the way that this message is resonating with people. And some people call it, you know, copium or whatever, but I don't think it is. I think oftentimes we have numbers backing up what we're saying. I think that's something we're kind of sticklers about. And we're realistic about the quality of the team. And I think one type of person that has been identified this year is the person who goes into every year insisting that the Yankees are going to be terrible just so they can eventually say they're right. And that kind of person's having a field day. But like, I'm glad that our message is not resonating with that person, because I think there are some philosophical differences that it would be hard to reconcile.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've seen enough Yankees baseball to know the difference between good teams, transcended teams, bad teams, awful teams. Like, we've seen some, maybe this might be the worst record-wise that we've seen, but I think this team has elements to it that, you know, teams from 10 years ago wouldn't step up. I mean, it goes back to what I was saying, or what we've been saying, like, is this, you know, is this a failure of a season, or is it a down year and a transition year to a new core? I mean, I think either way is realistic to look at it because of the strong farm system, the guys who are getting worked into the majors, and that just didn't exist 10 years ago. So, like, it's, I think, perspective combined with the analytics. And yeah, I mean, I think we're, you know, we're not emotionless. This is obviously a pretty bad season. We're both tuned out, upset, depressed, all of the above. Totally. And I think the way we handle it varies. Like, I know that you probably lean more into the, you know, the coaches and managers don't matter more than I do. So I think there's differences in that approach as well. But at the end of the day, I mean, like, I think you can be upset about it, or you can actually look at what's on the field, try to figure it out, see what makes sense, see what is attributable to random variation. Because if you've watched enough baseball, you know that, like, if there was no random variation in baseball, there wouldn't be massive year-to-year turnarounds. There wouldn't be surprises. There wouldn't be disappointments. That stuff exists. Like, you can't predict baseball is there for a reason. And I think trying to make sense of that best you can is just a more educated, enlightened way. You know, you can be upset. That's fun. But if you want to figure it out, like, why not give it a shot? And I think we do a good job at least of being open to those discussions. And I don't think either of us have really shot people down who are engaged in that stuff. Like, shooting people down comes from when people push back and are not willing to at least hear other sides of arguments.
Yeah, I've said on Twitter, to people we interact with on Twitter, that I'm not always right. I'm often confident, and I often am making drawing data-driven conclusions, which those things, I appear to, how should I say this? I come off as confident because my opinions are often well-founded, and I often end up being right. I am not always right. I've been very publicly wrong about many things in baseball, including my continued insistence that if someone could just teach Javier Baez plate discipline, he would be a top 10 player in the game. With that said, that means that there are people who can show up and have a different opinion and be right. But there has to be something to the argument, you know? Like, there has to be a competing thesis. And oftentimes, the competing thesis either doesn't exist or is based on stuff that is so easily disproved by the data. And I think that's, like, endemic to baseball Twitter in a way that we're never going to fix, and that's how some people think about this stuff, and it is what it is. But, like, we get in arguments and discussions with people, and sometimes, like, agree to disagree is what the data tells you to do. Like, people can see the same information and react differently without having made an unreasonable leap. And I like interacting with those people. I don't like interacting with the people who make the unreasonable leaps.
Yeah, I'm just glad that Andrew Benintendi is not a Yankee anymore, because even though the Yankees might have been good last year, at least the worst arguments we had with each other were solely around him.
Like, literally in the 16 years of us knowing each other, the most heated arguments we've had are about him. And, you know, I don't think there are too many things that we have disagreed on all that vehemently in that time, but still, he was really a wedge issue for us.
Yeah, I think that even though it might have been a dark moment, I think things like that show how we always bring different blends of analytical and emotional viewpoints to it in a way that, you know, I think is not just getting angry at each other to get angry, but keeps things interesting even when the Yankees don't necessarily hold up their end of the bargain.
And of course, there are ways to lie with statistics, or at least to mislead. You may have seen the graphic that I posted comparing the Notre Dame and Michigan football programs since 2012, in which one of the categories on which I measured those programs was wins against Oklahoma, Clemson, USC, Ohio State, Florida State, Miami, and LSU. Notre Dame has 16, Michigan has 2. Michigan has only played like one or two of those schools in that time period. So I was being completely and intentionally misleading, but you know, such is life. Did I do that with Andrew Benintendi? No, he made the case entirely for me. He's bad at baseball. He's bad at baseball this year too. And if I were the White Sox, I would be embarrassed that a guy who is still a Babbitt merchant hitting 318 on balls in play and hitting 276 overall is a below average major league hitter because he's slugging 374 like I always knew he would. Anyway, the Benintendoff won by me, clearly. Whipple, there's a lot of stuff to hate about this baseball season, whether it's big picture baseball stuff like Shohei Ohtani having a UCL tear or Shohei Ohtani having a UCL tear. I can't think of any other big picture baseball stuff that one would hate. But there's also stuff that we can be excited about with the Yankees, even though we pretty much hate everything that's happened to them this year. So what we're going to do, back and forth, three picks each, a draft of the stuff that we're excited to watch with the Yankees over the rest of the season, because I think a lot of us out here need some encouragement to root for something beyond the wins and losses as we watch the rest of the season, because it could get ugly, probably has gotten ugly, honestly, already. I don't think we can sugarcoat it anymore. So I'll let you have the first pick, and I have a sneaking suspicion I know what it's going to be.
I mean, there's really only one thing it could be. There's one reason that I am still invested in Yankees baseball, and I mean, there's more than one reason, but there's one big reason that will cause me to turn on a game and be on the edge of my seat watching every pitch that comes out of Gerrit Cole's hand, because I think Gerrit Cole's Cy Young push is maybe the top story still to root for. As everyone knows, I'm a big Gerrit Cole narrative pusher, and I was very vocal last year that his 2022 quote-unquote down year was only because of home runs that may or may not have been juice balls that elevated his home run rate to allow him to give up the most home runs in the league, even when all of his peripheral statistics were just as good as his Cy Young runner-up season in 2021. But his playoff performance didn't convince people. People are still down on him. They were not aware that he was about to have one of the best seasons of his career. In a funny way, and I think ironically, that his numbers really have not improved in any significant way from his Yankees performance in 2020 to 2022, except for the fact that his home run rate is down to a Yankees low, a actual league average rate, if not one of the better numbers in the league. I think he's eighth in home runs allowed, which for a guy who eighth in home runs allowed being the least home runs allowed. And somehow Sonny Gray's out here running like a 0.3 home runs allowed per nine inning rate, which is like, I don't understand that. But Gerrit Cole fixed that issue, allowing less barrels, about the only significant change he made. And all of his other numbers are worse. He's walking not that many people, not significantly different from last year. He's striking out less people, for sure.
All the
underlying numbers are not significantly better. They're still at the top of the league. But Gerrit Cole is going to win this Cy Young, if he's going to win it, in an old-fashioned way. He's going to lead the league, or he's on pace to lead the league in both innings and ERA. And I think it would be fitting if he won this year, partly because I think people are going to appreciate the old-fashioned statistics and not perceive the probably less impressive performance. But also, Gerrit Cole fixed his biggest issue from last year, and one of the best pitchers in the league. Sometimes it's not about, you know, the savant numbers or what the FIP and xERA say. You know, I sound like a boomer, but if you're as good as Gerrit Cole, like, and you can allow runs at a league best low rate and pitch most innings in the league, it doesn't really matter what the other stuff is because you're having a really great year. And Gerrit Cole is, at the end of the day, those might be the only things he leads the league in. But I think the fact that he's able to do this, to be the top at the top starter in those categories, but also still really good in the other things. And the thing that stuck out to me the most, he's the top starter in win probability added behind a few relievers from the Orioles and Blue Jays. And I think that kind of sums up the year in which he's really kept this team in the race when he had the opportunity. But I think as long as he stays the course, he's going to win. Of course, we saw against Boston that might not happen. Like, he always is prone to the blow up start. But as long as he is somewhat of a above league average pitcher for the rest of the year, I think the narrative's on his side. And I think that's really important in this type of voting. Personally, for me, I am ready to at least celebrate some small success from this year and go back to some preseason tweets and call out the appropriate people. We have nothing else right now, so you better believe in November, if that happens, I will be out in full force. It is my, the issue. If I'm a one-issue voter, my issue is Gerrit Cole.
Yeah, Gerrit Cole is... It's funny because this is probably Gerrit Cole's worst season as a Yankee in many ways. If you look at the underlying numbers as far as particularly walks and strikeouts, but then he gets a little bit of home run per fly ball luck. Like, the league average is 12.7% of fly balls go for home runs. For Cole, it's been 10.7, and suddenly he's amazing. Like, his ERA is under 3. And I do think you're right that the people who just look at ERA and innings will push him over the top. Sonny Gray has a 4.8% home run per fly ball rate. So if you're looking for a big regression candidate, look no further than Sonny Gray. He is in trouble. Anyway, my pick now, and because of all this BS about the Yankees not being able to develop players, I'm going to pick a guy who I am already deeming a player development success. And I'm just going to say, let's continue to watch the Anthony Volpe breakout. Anthony Volpe has a 120 WRC plus in his last 228 plate appearances, which goes back to June 13th against the Mets when he changed his batting stance. And he's been like really, really good. Like, I don't ever expect Anthony Volpe to be a 120 WRC plus bat reliably, but I might need to adjust those expectations because in that time, he's walking almost 10% of the time. He's striking out basically a league average amount of the time. He's slugging over 440, maybe closer to 450 today that he homered again. And it's not a crazy BABIP thing. Like, he's super fast. He sprays the ball. His BABIP's only been 302 in that time. So when I think about what this means for my perception of Anthony Volpe's ceiling, I'm starting to think of him as more of a legitimate offensive player than I did previously. Now, the concerning thing, obviously, is that in that time, his average exit velocity numbers have been unimpressive. I think it's 87.5 or not quite 88 miles an hour, which is not great, but if Anthony Volpe finishes this season and from the middle of June on, he's a 255, 335, 445 hitter for a, you know, 115 to 120 WRC plus, that meaningfully changes the way I think about how he fits into this Yankees offense over the rest of the season. And his numbers are really pulled down by the fact that after his hot start, he got miserably cold and he was a 64 WRC plus hitter, I think, at one point. It was 67 the day before the breakout against the Mets. Like, things got dire, but he pulled himself out of it. He made some changes and he started to rake. And the version of Anthony Volpe that really hits is a super valuable guy in an offense. And look, dude, it's easy to forget This guy is going to be 22 when next season starts. He will not have turned 23 yet when next season starts. So to watch him develop this much just over the course of this year, it doesn't have to stay linear. It can start to flatten out. And if he maintains at something that even resembles this level, like, holy cow, is that a valuable player?
Yeah, I mean, I think the age thing is the biggest thing for me. I mean, when Aaron Judge was 22, he was in the low minors. I mean, even when Gary Sanchez was 22, he hadn't really debuted yet for the Yankees. When Luis Severino was 22, he was still finding his place. Like, it's so rare for a guy to come up at such a young age and be transcendent. I mean, that's why Juan Soto was celebrated, because that is a very rare thing. And for Anthony Volpe to come up and hit like that, and, you know, at the end of the day, if his WRC plus gets above 100, his defense is honestly, you know, probably maybe his strongest trait above league average at this point. And he's in legitimate gold glove conversation. He stabilized the shortstop position. And if you think the June to the end of the year Anthony Volpe is the true talent Anthony Volpe, for, you know, even maybe he's a true talent a level above this, because we've seen the development happen in real time. But if that's the floor, I think you're looking at something that the Yankees haven't had at shortstop for a number of years. And I think that I'm also really excited for that. I think he's a key part of their future for sure. But I'm honestly, like, really interested in, I guess I'm just interested in how developing being a player at the major league level, like the Yankees said, we're going to continue his development at the major league level. I'm interested to see if that gamble paid off, because it has much bigger implications than how it affects the 2023 Yankees. If we look back in 2 to 3 years and he's a superstar, maybe that extra year in the bigs really was important for figuring it out. Because you know what? Like, if you're going to be optimistic about the 2024 Yankees, it really helps to know that Anthony Volpe is capable of doing this at the major league level, as opposed to having 2.5 months, 3 months of him. Maybe he has those initial 3 months of struggling. And then you're talking about a much different story. And that's a much more uncertain story. And knowing this fan base, it probably is a much more dour story. So I think I'm really excited for how this is all developed. And I'm most excited to see if the plan to develop him at the major league level in the long term pays off, and if these improvements are just the first of many improvements. Because when guys can hit well at a young age, that says a lot more than, you know, a guy if he was 26 or 27 and doing this. I think he has a very bright future, and I think we've seen a lot of really great things from him this year.
This is a snake draft, right?
Sure.
Okay. So
unless you take my pick, and then it's
I guarantee you I'm not taking your pick.
Okay.
On the topic of developing young hitters, we have a ridiculously small sample from Everson Pereira. He's not doing an incredible job of lifting the ball. He is striking out a lot, as we knew he would, although it's coming down. It was in the 40s. Now it's in the 30s. He's taking some pitches. I think as he develops, he'll get some more calls. The eye will develop a little more. The BABIP isn't there. But again, Everson Pereira, very young player. The thing that I love about Everson Pereira is I just want you to tell me if you can think of what all these guys who I'm about to mention have in common. Paul Goldschmidt, Andrew Vaughn, Jose Abreu, Jake Fraley, Jazz Chisholm, Jose Ramirez, Jeremy Pena, Miguel Cabrera. Let's see, who else do I want here? Tyler O'Neill, Taylor Ward. Who else would I like to pick? Jamer Candelario, Joey Votto, Nicholas Castellanos, Nathaniel Lowe, DJ LeMahieu, Adley Rutschman, Francisco Lindor. There have got to be a couple more fun ones to pick here. Ozzie Albies, Freddie Freeman, JT Realmuto, Anthony Rizzo. What do you think all these guys have in common?
High max exit velocity.
So you're on the right track. It's actually that they have not hit a ball as hard this year as Everson Pereira has.
Oh, I was on the right track. I know my
Everson
audience.
Everson Pereira's though. Max exit velocity is 111.8 miles an hour. he's one of 142 players to hit a ball at least that hard, but a lot of guys haven't. Like, Everson Pereira, to come up and sting the ball the way he has a few times is a really, really encouraging sign. Because there are plenty of good players who will not hit a ball faster than 110 all year. And for him to come up and just do that immediately, that shows bat speed that we should be excited about. It shows barrel skills that we should be excited about. Like, Everson Pereira is doing stuff that, as far as projectability of major league talent, we ought to be excited about. And as the resident, like, loves guys who just destroy the baseball guy here, I think it's worth being excited about.
That would go great on a t-shirt.
Loves guys who just destroy the baseball guy.
Yes. Everson Pereira has been impressive in how he's looked, although, you know, the numbers aren't there, but we're talking about more than just the statistics. I think that stat is not surprising, because we knew that's kind of who we were getting, a guy who can hit the ball hard and is trying to work on holes in his swing. And it's kind of been what I've thought, in good and bad ways. But I think the most important thing is that those numbers, I think people think that a stat like the one you just said isn't that indicative, that, you know, oh, it's just one hard hit ball. But, like, max exit velocity is very telling in a lot of ways, and you can't just do it. Like, you have to show ability to hit the ball hard. If you can show that ability, then you're already half of the way there. And I think Pereira, along with Peraza and hopefully Wells, is part of that, you know, the non-Volpe group of young guys that are going to probably end the year with statistics that aren't going to, you know, they're not going to pop off the page. They're not going to make your head spin. But I think at the same time, it's just getting them the reps and getting them consistent playing time, which, as I said last week, I wanted to see, and we certainly have seen it.
We have. We
definitely have seen it. But just having those opportunities to make the kind of observations as the one you just made just gives you that much more information to know, to be excited about, or to inform your decision making for the 2024 season. So for me, I definitely am excited for Pereira, and I think I would loop the other kind of prospects that haven't really played as much in the majors into that group, and just getting the most information possible to make 2024 and 2025 and so on, to make that team better as well. Because, like, next spring, you're going to have Dominguez, and Dominguez is definitely going to get the Volpe treatment by fans and media. And Dominguez isn't going to have played a game like Volpe. So I think when you have situations like that, having guys that you know can, at least you know they can or cannot play because you've seen them play major league games, at least you have that background information. So, you know, if Dominguez is if he's pushing on the door for a spot, you're not, you know, maybe you're not as desperate as, you know, needing multiple holes, because you have Pereira and Peraza and Wells to fill those holes. I guess that's a long way of saying the more information you have, the better.
Totally. So snake draft means you have your last two picks.
So I'm going to pick a hitter and a pitcher that I'm excited about watching, because, I mean, I could say, I was thinking about saying the Yankees just generally playing spoiler, but I don't know. I mean, would that excite you? Like, it'd be fun to see them win games, but, like, I just generally think people get excited about teams playing spoiler when, like, that's not that exciting, especially we've seen the Yankees play important games as we have. So I'm going to focus.
Yeah, I'm an elite hater and I don't even care about that.
Okay. Yeah. Like, let's just focus on storylines, players, whatever, non-game results. So for me, there's two guys. I'll start with the pitcher, and it's Clark Schmidt, because I think Clark Schmidt has had an interesting year. In some ways, it hasn't been a good year. I mean, the numbers do not pop out at you. Definitely a lot of, going back to the Savant, a lot of blue on the Savant page. Nothing, you know, he's not striking out a ton of guys. His walk rate is good, but, you know, that's probably his best calling card besides just having good fastball spin. But the results have been there, and they've consistently been there since May in a way that I think has really started to open people's eyes. And not in a way that's going to make you think you have the next ace, but in a way that, knowing he can go out and pitch 5 to 6 innings, we saw him pitch into the seventh. We're seeing him pitch at a level that he hasn't pitched at before. He's never pitched this many innings. We know he's been injury prone in the past, but he's been out there every fifth day. And even with the 8-run Braves blow up a few weeks ago, he has a sub-4 ERA since May. And I'm impressed by one. I'm impressed by a young guy just rebounding from a pretty miserable start, in which I think a lot of players would not have been able to turn it around as he has. But I'm also intrigued at what this means for the future of the rotation, because Nestor Cortez, Gerrit Cole, Carlos Rodon are locked in, and the back end of the rotation I think will be pretty open into next year. But I think having the future Yankees pitching stars of tomorrow not be relied on to fill two spots, to have Clark Schmidt be someone you can have as the fourth starter and give the Drew Thorpes and Will Warrens of the world an opportunity to win that fifth spot, or having him as a trade bait for a center fielder or someone else. I mean, the opportunities are so much more they're so much more expansive than what we thought the Clark Schmidt situation was going to be in middle of May. And for a team that everyone has kind of either regressed or not performed up to expectations, I think having a guy who, again, hasn't blown people away, but has consistently given the Yankees a chance to win the game every fifth day, where I think only Gerrit Cole is the only other guy you could say that is doing that in this rotation, is exciting. And I think it's something I'm interested to continue this year and next year. Just something that has made me want to tune into Yankees baseball, which hasn't been a lot of reasons right now.
Clark Schmidt has 17 games this year with 5 or more innings pitched and 3 or fewer earned runs allowed. That's on par with Dylan Cease and Christian Javier. It's more than Shane McClanahan, Jesus Luzardo, Dane Dunning, Justin Verlander, Marcus Stroman, Max Scherzer, Nathan Eovaldi, Sandy Alcantara, Julio Urias, Joe Musgrove. I understand some of these guys have been hurt at times this year, but this is for the narratives.
No, we're pushing narratives. This does not, context doesn't
more
matter.
More than Shohei Ohtani, more than Aaron Nola, more than Clayton Kershaw, more than Yu Darvish, more than Lance Lynn, more than Shane Bieber. Like, this guy is, Clark Schmidt is not a number one or two starter. If Clark Schmidt is your fourth or fifth starter, you're in a perfectly good place because you know what you're going to get. Every so often there's going to be a blow up, but most of the time he is going to pitch between 5 and 6 innings and give up between 2 and 3 runs. That I'd sign up for that 8 days a week. So I totally agree on the Clark Schmidt point. Obviously we talked a lot with Ryan last week about the guys who the Yankees have in the high minors who are going to push to potentially occupy a spot that Clark Schmidt would like. But what he's done this year at the major league level has been more than I expected out of him. What's your last thing?
Yeah, I think to that point too, he's going to make them earn it if that's what happens.
Totally.
And that's what you want. You want guys pushing each other and you don't want to be forced into picking someone who's not ready for a spot. I'll go back to the offense, and we've been talking about a lot of young guys, but I'm going to turn to a veteran who's really kind of reemerged in the last few weeks, the second half of the year. I think DJ LeMahieu is maybe not fully back, but definitely I would rather see him hitting like this than the DJ LeMahieu we saw in May and June. I'd say he's on the right track. I think obviously he homered 3 times this weekend.
That
but
helps.
Since July 1st, he's hitting .285, .389, .416, 162 plate appearances. That will go up after today's stats, which I didn't include. But the first half, DJ LeMahieu 2022, which is not unreasonable. I'm not talking about 2019 DJ LeMahieu. But first half last year, he hit .288, .393, .435. And I think that version of DJ LeMahieu is what we said at the beginning of this year, in the middle of this year. That's the version we've seen recently. And even though he might not have the power that he had in the juice ball era, which no one does, but that DJ LeMahieu is a really useful player. And it seems to me that he's at least getting back to being something close to that. And obviously I'm hedging because he's 35 and you don't know how the next 3 years are going to unfold. But I think the Yankees are at an interesting place with the future infield. But no matter what they do with Gleyber Torres, no matter how Oswald Peraza is utilized, there are spots to be had, and DJ LeMahieu can essentially fill most of them. And especially as he gets older, I think having him kind of, we said this before, signed to be a super utility guy, having him transition back to that role, honestly, like he's in that role right now. I don't know if we, you know, what the distinction is at this point, but it's really just a useful player to have when he hits like that. And there's, we have evidence, we have recent evidence that he is able to hit like that for something approximating close to a third of a season. So I'll be interested to see if that continues, because again, just as with Clark Schmidt, I think it gives the Yankees flexibility and how to deploy next year's infield. I don't want them to rely on DJ LeMahieu, but if this contract and this player is to be useful over the second half of his contract, I think there needs to be hitting like this, and that allows the defensive flexibility and versatility to be something useful as opposed to just a nice feature. So one of the things that, you know, we don't have to get into the Sean Casey conversation, but a second half offensive highlight where, you know, there might be a lot of dull spots in the recent Yankees hitting performance. Just something that I've enjoyed watching as well.
With today factored in his last 131 plate appearances, which goes back to the Rockies series, DJ LeMahieu has a 158 WRC plus, which I would say there's a lot to like there. My last thing is Jonathan Loáisiga. I have long said what a joy it is to watch Jonathan Loáisiga pitch, and that has remained true. Since coming back from injury, he's only thrown 7 2/3 innings. He, in that time, has allowed just 2 hits. He's not allowed any runs. He's not missing bats to the extent that I'd like him to, but I basically think the Yankees brought him back as, like, this is his spring training, and if anyone is going to limit batting average on balls in play, it's Jonathan Loáisiga getting 60% ground balls. So I love the guy. I think he is a ton of fun. I think that the Yankees would be wise to extend him because he wouldn't be all that expensive and he's ridiculously effective. I just think it's fun watching him pitch, and I think that if, given how frequently late game situations have made me sad this year, it's nice when late game situations can include things that make me happy, and one of those things is watching Jonathan Loáisiga pitch.
Yeah, I'm right there, especially if the Yankees sense there's a market for relievers this winter. They have the flexibility of, I think, trading someone like Clay Holmes, who probably has more value, and installing Loáisiga as the closer. I'd be comfortable with him as the closer.
Absolutely.
He's a guy that when he is healthy, he, especially this year, you know, we've seen a lot of really great things, and it's just the trouble of staying on the field, but maybe that knocks his cost down, you know, to a point where they feel comfortable extending him or not trading him. I mean, he's a lot of fun, and he's been such an important part of the last few years, especially 2021, I think, was, you know, one of the most fun seasons I remember watching from a reliever was the 2021 emergence of Loáisiga. I mean, I still remember the doubleheader day, you know, working out of the Red Sox jam and that the reaction after. Mm-hmm. So that the pitcher is still there, and if that's, you know, following someone like him and seeing what he has to be, you know, utilized in the next year, I think is one of the things that will be enjoyable to watch, because, you know, even if the wins aren't there, individual performance from Loáisiga goes a long way to how they're going to feel about constructing their 2024 bullpen. So a lot of fun Yankees have disappointed this year, but at least Jonathan Loáisiga is pitching well right now.
Love it. So if anyone out there who is still subjecting themselves to watching these games was looking for something or a group of things potentially to be excited about as far as watching these games over the rest of the year, you just got 6 things. So pay attention to those. We certainly will be. Whipple, think it's time for us to wrap up here, unless you have anything else we missed.
No, I think it's time.
All right, so we're going to wrap up with confidence, as always, and I'll throw it to you. I mean, this almost feels like a pointless exercise at this point in this year, but let's hear it.
Yeah, well, there's still a few weeks left of the 2023 Yankees, and as we said, the dust is starting to settle on what this team is. And so if I'm just going to give a confidence rating on this year's team, I think it's probably somewhere between a 3 and a 4, and that's probably generous. I mean, it's more just the benefit of, like, I think, I don't know, just enjoying watching the things that we talked about, and maybe I should just say 0, because that's, like, the season is probably not going to result in the playoffs. But I feel like at this point, we do have to look a little big picture, and all the things we talked about made me realize that, as I've said, this team has a great young core coming up, and we're seeing it be implemented. I think that process is occurring a little quicker than maybe it would if they were in the playoff hunt. And maybe for, you know, the long-term successes of the team, that's the best thing. So the revised, expanded confidence to encompass the Yankees as a whole and not just the fortunes of this year's team, I think I can go up to a 6 on that, because the fact that the guys are here and playing is exciting, and we haven't seen sustained success yet, but like you talked about with Volpe, we've seen a lot of things to be happy about, and I hope that more guys will be promoted to join them, and even following Jason Dominguez in the minors or Drew Thorpe in the minors and Spencer Jones being promoted. If that's your focus for the next month, I think all power to you, because it's a pretty great focus given how that these guys are performing. And even looking for the little things like the DJ LeMahieu stats we talked about, and seeing if, you know, Anthony Rizzo can come back and show that he's recovered. Just little things. I think not wanting the Yankees to be spoiler for the sole purpose of entertainment, like, that's fine if you don't, like, I don't really care about that stuff, but I think it's fair to watch the games and only focus on those things or tune in to see how those things develop. And in that respect, there's a lot more to be excited about than other Yankees teams we've seen. Again, 2013 Yankees, you tune into those, it's those September games. It was the Mariano Rivera retirement tour, and that's really great, but there is basically no reasons to be optimistic about the future with those teams. So that's not we're not apologizing for the 2023 Yankees. We're being honest that there's a lot of really bright spots to focus on.
Well, if you were lucky around this time that year, you got to see Brent Littlebridge.
How could I forget?
Brent Littlebridge was a phenomenal immaculate grid answer today. I think you're right that you kind of have to reframe, and this is the utility to us of having left it open-ended this whole time. You kind of have to reframe the confidence rating as far as how likely you think this team is to accomplish the goals that you now have for it, or something along those lines. And I'd really like to see Austin Wells this year. I might even like to see Jason Dominguez this year. I'm not overly confident that we'll see either of those guys, but rosters are about to expand marginally, so they're going to have to call some people up. We'll see who those guys end up being. But yeah, I was at a 5.5 last week. I think that the fact that they're playing Pereira and Peraza is really encouraging. The fact that Oswald Peraza, like, I don't understand anything about his offense at the major league level, is a little bit discouraging. I think that Luis Severino and Carlos Rodon combining to throw, like, whatever it was, 17 pretty darn good innings in the last week, again, BABIP aided, but hey, I'll take it, is a great thing. So I think there are some things, you know, again, all the things we drafted as well, I think there are some things to be optimistic about and to feel good about over the rest of the season, having put the, like, World Series dream to bed. I think I'd be a lot better equipped to answer this question in a few days when I see, you know, is Austin Wells up and getting playing time? I'm probably at like a 5. I don't know. It's, yeah, like I said, kind of a pointless exercise at this point. Well, Whipple, we're going to wrap this up. Any parting shots before we do that?
Yeah, we've engaged in a lot of discussion about narrative pushing, and I'd be remiss to say that even this is before today's home run, but Kyle Higashioka in his last 2 months is an OPS that's closer to 800 than 700 and has a knack for hitting timely home runs after he screws up in the field. And if I cared more about Kyle Higashioka, I mean, I do really care about him. Maybe if you cared more, I think there is like Benintendi light potential, but it's hard to have that same level of vitriol for the backup catcher. But if we're talking about pushing narratives, I'm just going to keep pushing the Kyle Higashioka narrative, and you can't stop me.
I don't like that guy. all right, so we're going to wrap this up. Whipple, it was a joy as always. People can find us at yankeesfiles.com, everything we do. They can also follow us on Twitter, where we are at Yankees Files. They can follow us, if they want, on TikTok, where we're at Yankees Files Podcast. If you like the podcast, which is available wherever you get your podcasts, we hope that you'll rate, review, and subscribe. You should only do those first two things if you like the podcast, though. If you don't, please just subscribe, download it, listen to it, whatever. But don't, like, fill us up with those negative ratings. Nobody has time for that. With that said, we will be back, not same time, same place next week, as we will both be away, but same time, same place in a couple weeks to recap whatever nonsense has happened with this team in that span. And until then, let's go Yankees.